Hey, good morning, everybody. I want to welcome you to this event on the role of IT in transforming American higher education. And we have a great panel this morning. I want to introduce folks. I'll just make a few opening remarks. We'll hear from everybody. We should have plenty of time for questions. And also, if you are watching online and you want to tweet a question, you can do that to at ITIFDC. So I'll start in order of folks in this order here. We'll start with Cameron Evans. Cameron is the Chief Technology Officer for U.S. Education for the Microsoft Corporation. And in that role, Cameron is responsible for shaping and executing Microsoft's technology and policy strategy in U.S. education. He also chairs Microsoft Higher Education Advisory Group and the K-12 Advisory Group. Before he was named National Technology Officer and CTO in this space, he was a group sales manager for Microsoft Higher Education. He's also served as Microsoft Liaison for the School Interoperability Framework Association, and before that was a K-12 CIO and cabinet level executive. He has an MBA from the University of Texas in Dallas. Next is Steve Ruth. Stephen is the Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University and the Director of the International Center for Applied Studies in Information Technology. And in that role, he focuses on leveraging the use of IT in large organizations. He's also been Chair of the Technical Committee on Personal Computing for IEEE's Computer Society and was elected to a 3-year term to the American Association of Advancement of Sciences Council of Affiliates for International Programs, and was also a distinguished lecturer for the Association for Computing Machinery. And Stephen has a PhD from Wharton University. Next is Steve Crawford, who is a research professor at the George Washington University Institute of Public Policy. Prior to that, he was a vice president for policy at CFEB and deputy director of Brookings Metro Policy Project and also director of workforce programs at the National Governors Association. Steve has taught at Bates College, University of Maryland, and was an assistant dean at University of Pennsylvania. And he has a PhD in Columbia. And he's also working on a report on higher ed reform and particularly around IT with his colleague Bob Sheets. Bob is the Director of Research, Business Innovation Services at the University of Illinois at Champaign, where he specializes in a number of areas, including education policy and research. And Bob received his PhD from the University of Illinois at Champaign. And lastly, we're being joined by Candace Thiel, who is, I think, having a little bit of Skype video problem, but I think we should be able to at least hear Candace. Candace, can we hear you?
I think you got me muted.
No, I can hear you.
Okay.
And you can hear us, obviously. Great.
I hear you.
Okay. And if it's possible to get a picture of you, that would be wonderful. But if not, we will work with voice.
I can email anyone.
Yeah, we can just put it up there, and then Alexis, you just kind of move it while she's talking. So Candace is director of the Open Learning Initiative at Carnegie Mellon University, and is also co-director of OLNet, which is an international open educational research network. Her focus is on R&D and applying the results from learning sciences to the design, implementation, and evaluation of open web-based learning experiments. She's had a number of positions in this area. Sorry about that. Including serving on a working group for the Department of Education and co-author of the National Educational Technology Plan, and also a working group of the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology on STEM education. So, why are we doing this? ITIF has focused a lot on innovation policy in a wide variety of areas and industries. This is an area, I think, that is sort of one of several in the U.S. economy that you might say is an innovation laggard. And there's several big problems with higher education. Almost all the attention in policy circles when Congress reauthorizes the Higher Ed Act is largely about how do we subsidize more people so low-income kids can afford college. which I'm, which is fine, but it ignores two other key problems, and one of those is quality. One study found that just of kids in college, seniors at the last semester of college, just 34% were fully quantitatively literate, and 40% were illiterate when it came to prose recognition. These are pretty staggering numbers when you think of it, but I guarantee you, unless you're here on false pretense, everybody here in this room would be fully quantitatively prose literate on that test. A recent study by NYU professors Richard Arum and Josipa Roska measured how much students learn between the time they get into college and the end of their sophomore year, and they found that a typical freshman who enters at the 50th percentile in terms of critical thinking and writing skills by the end of their sophomore year would have moved up to the 57th percentile. As they say, barely noticeable impact. But the other big problem, obviously, is cost. Since 1986, the overall inflation rate for the economy was 115%, but for college was 500%. And higher education suffers essentially from what's called Baumol's disease. This is a theory based on economist William Baumol, which is essentially that industries have differential rates of productivity. And because of that, you have differential rates of inflation, and the industries that have a hard time raising productivity will eventually see dramatically higher prices relative to the rest of the economy. And there's really only three answers to Baumol's disease when you think about it. One is it just happens, and people just have to suck it up and pay more, either individually or on a societal-wide level. That's a little bit about what we're trying to do now. Is we can just subsidize more higher ed funding, then we'll be able to deal with this affordability problem. But fundamentally, that is not a solution. You reach the limits of subsidies or just being able to pay high costs. The other answer is that people just consume less. As prices go up, people can't afford it, and they consume less. And obviously, that's not the right answer, given the importance of higher ed to our economy. So fundamentally, the only real answer to Baumol's disease is to figure out how to get an industry, how to cure the disease. In other words, how do we raise productivity and do that really through automation and technology? So one way to do that, I have a really interesting idea. We could give all the professors segues, and they could get to class 2 or 3 minutes sooner, and this would allow them to teach more, research more. Being obviously facetious, certain technologies that raise productivity in other industries don't really have much effect on higher ed. The real technology that is transformative potential, and that is IT. Higher ed is largely an information industry, and IT, whether it's on the actual production of the learning function, i.e. classes, or whether it's on all the back office things that higher ed does, accounting, enrollment, advertising, marketing, all of that. IT is critical to raising productivity, and that's really what we're going to talk about today. One last caveat. We haven't really seen radical tech-led transformation in the higher ed industry, but we have in many, many other industries. And we have a theory about that, which is maybe not all that profound, but the theory is largely that industries where the managers control the means of production are industries that embrace IT-led transformation. Good example of that is the travel industry. You go to check into an airplane, you can get your boarding pass on your cell phone, and you can just, you know, all, you know, increasingly automated. But industries where the workers control the means of production in a Marxian sense are largely resistant to IT-led transformation. And we see that in industries, for example, like real estate, where the real estate agents have resisted this. They control a core part of the production system, the MLS. And by their control of the MLS, they resist IT-led automation. Travel agents also had key controls over the travel agent system. And another one was optometrists, controlled the ability to give you a prescription and how you could fill it. All of these things. This is exactly what's going on in higher ed, I would argue, is professors largely control the means of production. And you talk to a college president, they're good. Their job is to market and raise money and to go to basketball games. They don't really control the organization the way the CEO of Intel or the CEO of GM controls the organization. So I think until we figure out how to combine both IT and business model transformation, we're not going to make the progress we need. And that's a lot of what we're going to talk about today. So I'll start, Stephen, if you want to start us off, and you're welcome to do it from here or here.
This is fine. Can I be heard okay this way? Thanks. This is not a popular topic, and I don't get a lot of fan mail when I present it or write about it. But I need to suggest two ideas before I start. Premises, you might say. First, if we're really serious about cost cutting, it has to show up directly in institutions' operating budgets. Real numbers, not simply themes or concepts. So my remarks are about approaches to reducing the operating budget through savings that show up in through IT interventions in faculty, administration, and IT itself at the institution.
Can you move the mic a little closer?
Yeah. How's this? Is this okay?
Perfect.
Total operating budgets are heading toward $500 billion for total university operating budgets and are slated to rise another $200 billion or more this year alone. Federal and state governments pour in $220 billion every year. That's mostly direct, but part of it is indirect. That's not small change. The second premise is not mine. Bill Gates and many others have brought it up often. Does the university have to be a place only? Instead, can it be a community of learners, not tethered to geography, but linked wherever they are by technology? Accepting these two premises, that is the possibility of actually reducing college operating budgets and untethering the university from being only about buildings and classrooms, that may open the door to major savings. Everybody knows the numbers. Tuition has been increasing at twice the rate of inflation for decades, more than even than healthcare. Average student loan burden on graduation is about $24,000, and another 2 million or more students will be added to that list this June, making the total number of loan holders close to 40 million persons, and total student loan debt is about $1 trillion. That's more than the credit card debt, total credit card debt, and it's also more than total car debt, United States. And it's up by 500% over the past decade, according to the New York Federal Reserve. By the way, over a quarter of these loans are now delinquent. President Obama complained about this. Rob mentioned it in another communication at a speech at the Governor's Conference just a few weeks ago, and he asked universities to find ways to reduce tuition. This would seem to be just a perfect case for the silver bullet of information technology: lower the unit cost of production, in this case, tuition. Maybe tuition payers can continue to allocate 25% of their household budget or more for higher education, and maybe government payments to higher education, state and federal, will rise to $300 billion or more, above the $220 billion I mentioned. But there's probably a tipping point out there where, and we may have reached it already. I'll suggest five painful, very unpopular, but I think completely feasible examples of way IT can dramatically change the equation, saving tens of billions every year in tuition instead of adding tens of billions. By the way, The Economist magazine a few months ago had a very interesting, very approving take on Professor Vance Fried's recent article. Actually, it was a report, and the numbers he's suggesting in terms of savings, particularly in terms of administrators and professors, are in the same area that I'm discussing. He noted that in some colleges there are more administrators than professors, or more administrators than faculty, and suggested there needs to be a greater scrutiny of both of these. So here are my five. The major IT embedded cost cutting innovation and intervention that I see on the horizon is the MOOC. MOOCs aren't new, of course, but that's massively open online course. During the 2011 fall semester, Stanford offered three MOOCs, computer science courses, and they were free for non-matriculated students as well. It was also available for Stanford enrollees. They had a couple of hundred Stanford students that took the course. These were not just stream courses with notes and syllabi like the ones that are available in their thousands from MIT. They're wonderful too, and Yale, and from Carnegie Mellon. Rather, the Stanford courses offered active course management tools, homework, graded quizzes, exercises, interaction with the professor through a student, through a mentor, midterm and final examinations and course grades. And incredibly, 300,000 people signed up for it. That's not too different from the total amount that signed up for all traditional higher education last year. It's in that same order of magnitude. One course, artificial intelligence, was taught by Sebastian Thrun, a very famous artificial intelligence professor. By the time of the midterm exam, 175 Stanford students were participating, 54 from the University of Freiburg, and another 23,000 non-Stanford students, and some of them did just as well as the Stanford students did. And to make the case even more interesting, to me, the pivot of what I'm going to mention here is the University of Freiburg actually had quite a few students in that course too, and they found a way, proctoring the exam, to offer University of Freiburg credit for that course. It was a MOOC from Stanford, but Freiburg gave credit, and so did about six other European universities then. It's a lot more than six now. So as I mentioned, Stanford isn't the only institution offering downloadable, free, high-quality courses. MIT has more than 2,000, and I think they are MOOC-ready, and they have their famous open courseware program, and it's now offering, they're offering their first MOOC this semester. Many newly formed companies may have their eye on something far bigger, what I refer to as the import-export model, where the net exporter's MOOC is used by the importer as a four-credit course. The importer pays a fee but gains major savings in faculty and labor expense, especially for high-volume courses. Students get the best experts and teachers in the world streamed to their laptops, to their offices, even their smartphones, plus homework and exam grading, Q&A with the professor, but instead of a class of 25, possibly a class of 2,500, maybe 25,000. Current obstacles are significant. A lot of people absolutely hate the idea. Maybe you do too. Registrars have trouble with it, understandably, and many university officials are not going to accept MOOCs. There are limits on outside credit, things like that, all completely understandable, but they're from the pre-MOOC era, I think. But if, say, hundreds of thousands of matriculants all over the United States want to enroll in hundreds of different MOOCs, the importing university would need considerably fewer teaching and admin positions. Who knows the scope that's possible, but there are a lot of new companies forming in Silicon Valley and Cambridge and probably in Pittsburgh and elsewhere that might be ready to ride this wave. MOOCs have three components that make them very competitive. The very best teachers in the world, exceptional tech and touch courseware and student services, and significant, scalable, per-cost savings at the importing institution. Obviously, this is hugely controversial. But keep an eye on MOOCs. They may shake up everything, just like the amazingly successful, wildly in-demand Khan Academy, with hundreds of teaching sessions that are getting tens of millions of hits. I use it myself. It's wonderful. By the way, as mentioned, I'm not ignoring the importance of face-to-face instruction. That's going to be with us always. That will always be part of the college experience, but there are lots of students, many more now than there were before, who are very comfortable with non-face-to-face in many courses. Why can't each university do this on their own without having to compete with MOOCs and the for-profits? First, because according to the latest Sloan-Babson report, they come out every year, two-thirds of permanent college faculty continue to be negative. They don't like online learning. They're against it. And they have some very good reasons for it. There are quite a few essays about why they don't like it. And second, if the university is thought of as only a place for face-to-face teaching, physical place only, major innovations like this, well, they'll never have a chance. So another major reduction in annual tuition costs could come from taking full advantage of the NCAT, the National Center for Academic Transformation. You probably all know about that. To me, it's an amazing organization. They're widely praised. The Gates Foundation, Sloan, federal government, everybody loves them. Their specialties for over a decade has been to redesign high-volume college courses, mostly undergrad courses, usually employing technology interventions. And they nearly always deliver higher learning, their various learning outcomes. They're always better. And frequently, the cost savings are dramatically high, very high. I'm not going to give you the numbers because they're a little bit... there was an Ohio State statistics course that they saved 30% on the labor costs. There was one at Brigham Young, 3,000 students in an English composition class where the same kind of savings were achieved, and retention was better, people wrote better essays, etc. If their approach can be unleashed on tens of thousands of courses instead of only hundreds, and assuming only 10% savings, they often get lots more than 10% savings. Instead of much higher results, they achieve billions could be shaved from budgets that could be transferred over to tuition. Two problems. These savings are mostly in personnel. That's not a popular thing. And also, NCAT has to be invited, so they don't get to go to these places unless they're invited. The next one of these I'm going to mention is already reducing tuition significantly. You probably know about it, and could easily save billions more in the future in buildings and faculty labor costs and other ways. Drastically changing the concept of the university as a physical place. I'm talking about the Western Governors University. They now have 25,000 students, and recently they set up they have a very large operation. Governor Daniels set it up in Indiana a few years ago. It's flourishing there. Now there's a big one in Texas as well, and many, many other states. If they're all competency-based programs, 50 or 60 university programs, fully accredited, and some all regionally and some also professionally, and they're all part of a not-for-profit college system. So they compete directly with the for-profits. Secretary of Education Duncan has praised the WG approach. It's low in cost, dramatically leverages existing facilities. The tuition is quite low. If their enrollment can grow tenfold again, just as it has in the last few years, it can be a major source in saving billions of dollars a year just in tuition, let alone buildings, et cetera. Okay. Another place to be saved could be in buildings. Buildings cost, even though the cost of most university now there are a third of all the students taking courses are taking at least one course by distance learning, but university construction is bricks and mortar is going up still 10%, so that's a savings. And also some big savings are possible. I've written about this several times in EDUCAUSE Quarterly in the IT budget right at the institution. So for example, you could save in shipping more things out to the Microsoft cloud, or LMSs, proprietary LMSs are quite expensive, etc. So there are lots of ways there, and I've written about that. And finally, even books, lots of savings for books. But I think sometime, maybe this year, critics may stop saying that states and federal government aren't spending enough, and they might turn directly to the colleges, especially faculty administrators, and ask them to take some pain. If that happens, we may see MOOCs and NCAT entering the mainstream, tuition costs down significantly, maybe even regionalization of entire faculty disciplines. Drastic reductions in construction, a redefining maybe of the word faculty, a lot more. So somewhere along the way, I think some beleaguered tuition payer may find a lot of these ideas very, very practical and useful, although there are a lot of other people who will not. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Candace, we'll turn to you now. We'll see if we get the slides up.
Okay, let me know when the slides are up. And then I will just say next slide when I want the next slide, because I can't control it from here.
Okay. We'll let you know there.
Coming.
Alexis, are we putting those up?
It's coming.
It's on the way.
It's coming, okay. All right, we're all set.
Great. So I'm just going to take a few minutes to talk about what's happening on the ground with the Open Learning Initiative at Carnegie Mellon as an example. And I want to just clarify something from the last wonderful talk, which is that the Open Learning Initiative is somewhat different. It's not a MOOC, but it's also not OpenCourseWare. So if you want to advance the next two slides, next slide. Is that the one that shows what the Carnegie Mellon Open Learning Initiative is?
Yep.
Great. So what the Carnegie Mellon Open Learning Initiative is, in contrast to a MOOC, or to an open courseware, is basically scientifically based open online learning environments that were designed to improve both quality and productivity in higher education. I agree that these two challenges for higher education right now, reducing costs and improving attainment, have to be dealt with at the same time. Trying to deal with one or the other separately won't get us where we need to go. So the difference in Carnegie Mellon's Open Learning Initiative is we bring together teams of faculty domain experts, software engineers, learning science researchers, human-computer interaction specialists, all together to look at how do we combine those expertise with the web to dramatically improve learning experiences. Now, I would disagree. I agree that what we're trying to do is to address Baumol's disease. I would disagree that what the way to improve address Baumol's disease is through streaming lecture, because what we've learned from the last 15 to 20 years of learning research is that just pushing information out to students, no matter how well explained, isn't how students learn. They learn by performing, by enacting, and then getting feedback on the quality of their performance that they can then use to try and perform again. So as we're designing the Open Learning Initiative courses, we're really focusing on what kinds of learning activities do we embed in the web-based environment that will support a student to perform, that we can give them immediate and direct feedback on in their performance so they can improve it. Next slide.
Yep.
When most people look at what are the affordances of the information technology in supporting education, they'll come up with one of these three things very quickly. Furthest to your left is that with a computer, you can see things and do things that you can't do in the real classroom, simulations of all kinds and so on. The center one is probably the one that's getting what the for-profits really capitalize on is convenience, that students, and also this is the point with MOOCs, that students can learn pretty much anytime, any place, when they want to, where they want to. So convenience is a huge benefit. And the third image is intended to show what a lot of people are also finding very exciting, which is connectivity. That using the computer, you can be networked to other students, to experts, to the world. And all those things are great. They're all wonderful powers of technology. But I would submit to this group that that's not the most powerful. The most powerful part of the technology is what Google has figured out. What Amazon has figured out. Next slide. The most powerful part of the technology is not just that we can push information out, but that pushing information out on the web just so far allows the technology to serve as a big data collector. And we can use that data to learn things, not just about that individual learner, but about learning in general, that then we can rapidly improve the learning experience. Just like Google, Netflix, Amazon is pushing that information out to collect information about you as consumers, we can do the same thing to collect information about people as learners. And that is what we call the killer app, which is this notion of using the technology to collect episodic learning data, in-the-moment interaction data from the student. I don't mean logins and logouts. I mean as students are actually working on tasks and trying to complete things, we can collect that data and use that data to build models of that learner and provide feedback based on comparing that student interaction against the cognitive models to the student to refine their performance, to the instructor so that they can know what's going on with their classroom better so they can use that if they have in synchronous time or in class time with the student much more effectively. And then also to the other two groups, the course design team and the learning researchers. So if you go to the next slide, I'll just give you a quick example of what I mean by that. So here, rather than having students do homework.
Next slide. There we go.
Yeah, do homework offline where we can't see what's happening. You can say to your student, work through module 3 of the OLI course. And as the student's working through the module, they're getting a lot of feedback and a lot of support from the computer-based system. But the system's also collecting those interactions from the student and using that information, next slide, the instructor dashboard. So this is actually an image out of a dashboard out of a course that's running right now. And what this tells the instructor is by learning outcome. Now this isn't a thing that's important to recognize about these dashboards is we're talking about the student's knowledge state. So all the information we're giving to the instructor is, given these are the outcomes of value for the student's knowledge state, this is how your class is doing right now. This is a snapshot of, if you were to give your students an assessment on any of these outcomes, this is how we predict they would perform. And the instructor can, next slide please, drill down on those dashboard, on that dashboard to get much more detailed information, such as the distribution of the students in their class that are in each of those categories of green meaning high competence, orange meaning medium competence, red being low competence, or gray being that the student hasn't done enough work in the system for us to be able to do a reliable prediction. And they could also click down further and see the actual student names. And I've blocked them off because they really are student names, and I didn't want to disclose those to a large audience. But the instructor, as you can see, can keep drilling down both on individual students and also on the knowledge components that those individual students are constructing in order to be able to achieve these outcomes. And the information we also collect, not just for the individual class that's using the course, but also we collect the information across classes for the design team. So for example, if the statistics course was being used in 60 different classrooms, 60 different institutions last semester, we can collect the data for across all those classes to do analyze where in the course are the activities supporting learning and where aren't they, so we can target the next round of improvement. I won't go into great detail, but this is one kind of representation of learning curve analysis that shows us by student interaction on different knowledge components whether learning is happening or not. The y-axis is what we call the assistance score. That's the number of hints or the amount of feedback the student needed embedded in a task in order to be able to master some particular knowledge component embedded within that task. And the x-axis is the number of opportunities the student had engaging in tasks to demonstrate that competence. And so we can probe the student's competence, not just by giving them sort of 20 questions on the same topic, but by giving them really complex tasks and looking at the competence of engaging in those subcomponents on any task embedded in a more complex, authentic task. This obviously would take more time than we have to explain how this works, but you kind of get the idea. This shows us that learning is happening, because when they're first given an opportunity to exercise that knowledge, they needed a lot of support, and over time, with many practice, each square is a practice opportunity, they needed less support. The sister project to my project at Carnegie Mellon is the Pittsburgh Science Learning Center, which uses the OLI courses as a research lab to understand and refine our ideas, our understanding of human learning. And that brings me to my final slide, which is, this is what I really think the power of the technology is for improving Baumol's disease in higher education. To provide better teaching practice, we need it to be grounded in much better understanding, much better theory about how people learn. In order to get that better theory about how people learn, we need a lot more data. Learning science is still a very young field, and we need a lot more data about a lot more students in a lot more contexts. And fortunately, the educational technology, if instrumented correctly, can collect that data for us. So we get this virtuous cycle to improve higher education, where we start with our current state about what we know about learning, to inform the design of the technology, and then we use the technology as that big network data collector to be able to provide that data to better refine our learning theory, which then better refines our information technology. And I will, if you just advance two more slides, I will end with my last quote from Herb Simon, who is a Nobel laureate at Carnegie Mellon. He said 10 years ago, improvement in post-secondary education will require converting teaching from a solo sport to a community-based research activity. And that is truly the power of the technologies that allows us to transform education from a solo sport to a community-based research activity.
That's great. Thank you, Candace. And we'll, as we get to the discussion, we'll come back. So thank you. And Cameron, you want to be here or here? Up to you.
Here is fine.
Okay.
Can everyone see me, or I can stand?
Put the lights back.
Okay.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here representing Microsoft and our views on what education and how we see the world evolving. I want to start first with the notion of consumerization. And we hear the consumerization of IT argument quite a bit, but I want to focus on consumerism at its core. And fundamentally, it's about you don't get to choose, I do. And you have to now cope, adapt with my choice. And as our consumers of education continue to look for ways that they can actually attain a degree, a diploma, or a certificate, they're going to look for ways that fit around their lifestyle, their economics, and not continue to endure the current system that we've had traditionally in the U.S. or around the world. They want education to actually really adapt and meet to them. And that consumerization trend is going to be something that all of us have to start thinking about, how technology allows us the flexibility, the agility to meet the needs of the consumer where they are, when they are. When you look at the fact that the Lumina Foundation did a report several years ago that over 38 million Americans, today it's probably 40 million Americans, have gone by a college and never graduated, that's not a good outcome. We know for the National Center of Education statistics that for those families that now have gone by a college and never graduated, they have young kids. And their young kids, if you don't have a parent that has a four-year degree, particularly the mother having a four-year degree, those students are not going to take 4 years of mathematics. They're not going to take 4 years of science. They're more likely not to graduate from college themselves. It would actually be better for the parent to have had an associate's degree than a three-year college education and never had graduated, based on the statistical data that we have today. And so we have to start figuring out, one, how do we get those people, the 38 million that went by a college and never graduated, to graduate, to get them back into the system so that they can be completed and be a positive exit. At the same time, preparing a new system that deals with the fact that we have an entirely new generation of students that have grown up in high definition. They have never heard a modem negotiate a connection to the internet. They know nothing about that. For them, it has always been on, it has always been interactive, but yet when they go to school, that engagement is very lo-fi compared to what they're experiencing everywhere else. So one of the areas that we've been deeply invested in is thinking about gamification of learning. And when I say gamification of learning, I'm not talking about turning everything into a video game. I'm talking about game mechanics, game theory applied in a learning context so that it, one, supports engagement, and supports the authentic learning that needs to happen in a competency-based learning world. I think Carnegie Mellon is on the right track. We call it telemetry, that data elements, is that when you're playing a video game, there's routine and constant feedback in video games today. The narratives in video games are much larger than life, and people like being involved in things that are bigger than themselves. And because they're constantly getting feedback on everything that they do, they know how to improve. Because in the video game world, people spend 80% of their time failing. And they need constant feedback so they can learn from each failure what not to do. And they enjoy failing in the video game world. They fail so spectacularly, they want to do it again. But when you fail spectacularly in education, not only do you not want to do it again, you don't have the money, the resource to do it again. And so we have to start thinking about how do those mechanics that we've learned from the gaming world apply to learning. A great example is with on a Microsoft Research Cambridge, where they are avid fans of the game Halo. Halo has been one of our biggest blockbuster technology games over the past 10 years. It's been a great franchise for the company. But when we were making the second generation Xbox, one of the things that they were thinking about was that when people play the game, oftentimes they were not met with enough challenge, and so it was too easy for them. And other times, people were met with so great a challenge that they could not win because they were being matched up with other competitors online that had superior skills to what they were capable of doing. So they wanted to figure out a way that they could identify the skill level of each player, and then match make them to the right player so that the outcome could possibly be a draw. not so that one person could win and one person could lose, but the outcome of a draw was the highest level of potential. And we had to figure out how to identify that skill in a very short sequence of steps. We call that technology true skill. Today it's in every product that ships on the Xbox platform, that within 9 plays of a game, we can identify what the skill level is of any player and then begin to matchmake them to whatever player is online in their universe. And we're looking at that same type of technology to identify skills in students so that we can matchmake them to content. Because when we look at the actual, what is the end game of the data being used in schools, it's not for the institution. The institution needs data, faculty need data, but the person who needs data the most is the learner. When you look at Netflix, it's a great example. Netflix doesn't make recommendations for you, they make recommendations for me. When I go to Amazon, the recommendations are for me. That data is being customized and tailored so that the next action I need to take can be programmatically done on my own behalf. That's the consumerization piece. I get to own my experience versus having to wait for it to be dictated to me by the institution. And data unlocks the ability for the individual learner to own their experience. Now, oftentimes we hear a lot of a conversation about what's the next big thing in education. And I want to assert today there is no next big thing. Just let that marinate for a moment. The next big impact or the next big shift, however, will come from small things all taken together. When you take what we've seen from search, what we've done with being able to discover content so that learning can happen more organically versus always having to look for something, if you have a tremendous amount of data about me, one of the things that should come from that is that I should never have to look for anything. That's one of the biggest problems when you look at how schools today use search versus what schools have. Schools have a tremendous amount of data about students, and they have a tremendous amount of data about courses. They have a tremendous amount of data about the faculty, but yet they do not employ that data on behalf of the participants in the institution so that they don't have to look for things. If you know that I am failing in a particular competency or I'm not getting it, the data that you collected from my interaction, that telemetry from all of those interactions, should automatically prefetch what I need that's based on a whole group of people being able to use that content to improve their learning. I should never have to look for it. I shouldn't have to go to the library. I shouldn't have to go to find a friend. The data should find me so that my learning outcomes can actually be achieved right there on the spot. When you're seeing all of these things happen in the social media world, people are not having to look for things. They discover them. When you fill out your profile on Facebook, a whole host of things find you that you probably didn't know were even looking for you. A whole host of things find you. But because they have that institutional knowledge about the consumer, why don't we use that same institutional knowledge inside of higher education so that things can begin to be discovered for our learners and the outcomes they have? At the end of the day, our biggest concern as a company is really around what are the outcomes that need to be achieved by the institution. When we look at students in that first year of college, if they can actually complete their first year, they have a higher degree of being able to complete a 4-year degree. If they don't make it through that first year, there's a problem. So finding ways to increase and really narrate that engagement so that they stay on track throughout the first year is super, super important to us. And then when they complete a 4-year degree or a 2-year degree, that they are able to demonstrate that competency. And so we have a high focus on competency-based education that drives the evidence of those outcomes. Can you actually deliver and do what it is that you think you've learned and show it to us in a meaningful way? Because from an employer standpoint, when we have people that show up that can't have basic skills, social skills, soft skills, more than just engineering skills, they're not going to be successful in large companies like Microsoft or anywhere else, and as we deal with the challenges today. And so that competency-based education is really rich. Whatever pathway you take to get there, that's not the biggest concern for us. We think that that pathway should be yours to choose. And just like Stanford and Freiburg had a way of creating the ability for those students at Stanford to actually get credit for in Germany for a course that was taken on the other side of the world, over time there needs to be a larger marketplace of courses like that so that the student doesn't have to figure out which institution to belong to. I can just go to one central location and an institution can give me a accreditation for the learning that I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Cameron. It must be because you're at Microsoft. You stopped exactly when the clock went to zero.
I didn't know there was a clock.
I won't make a comment about that. Faculty and university professors versus corporate.
He owns the music production.
Exactly.
So I'll use the podium
because
I'm going to put the PowerPoint here. And this is exciting material to build on. It's not always fun to go last, but in this case it is because we've talked about the escalating costs of higher education and the potential in these Stanford courses to try to get some economies of scale. And we've talked about the learning increases through instant assessment and feedback loops that Candace is doing at OLI and with lots of things. And then now Cameron's talked to sort of thinking about personalization through gamification and 9 steps to know the skill level and set the challenge right. And so if you stop and think for a moment, there are hugely exciting potentials for both improving outcomes, learning outcomes, and where we really started, reducing costs because of the affordability crisis in higher ed, through the application of IT. And so then you ask yourself, why aren't we moving faster? NCAT, it's true, is doing these wonderful course redesigns, but as I think Steve and Ruth mentioned, they're not being picked up many places. You usually have to pay them, some other university, to take one of those courses, and after the professor leaves, the course tends to die. So we have a going to scale problem. We have a problem of adoption of these new potentials, and the question is why and what can we do about it? So this, forgive all the funny IT here, but that's my 12-year-old daughter insisting that she design the cover page for my my thing here, and I may have to click more than once to advance it because she's built in all sorts of, I'm trying here and nothing's happening. Can we do a next slide in the back?
Yeah, just 1 second, hold on.
We're now back to Candace. Okay, this is what 12-year-olds do that I have no idea about. So here we go. So the first slide is about reflects an effort that Bob and I are taking to try to put, to learn what we can from other industries. The business school professors, most notably Clayton Christensen with The Innovator's Dilemma and a series of books after that, have been trying to figure out how does other industries undergo innovation. And let's just take some case studies. Let's take computers themselves, for example. It wasn't Wang Computer. Some of you are old enough to remember Wang Computers, or the people who made the mainframes who developed and were successful with minis. And it wasn't the manufacturers of the minis who were successful at developing and marketing desktops. It was Dell and Gateway coming in from the outside. And then you think about laptops and so on. And much of this is called disruptive innovation. Because what happens is the folks who produce the fancy early technology, which is very elaborate, think about an IBM 360, and only a university could afford one. The Defense Department had one, IRS had one. There were very few of them. They were very expensive, and it took great professional expertise to operate them. And now we're down to being able to do many of those same things, my daughter on her laptop. And that's because firms recognize the new technologies that came along that made it possible to do this cheaply and more conveniently, more mobily, were not of great interest to the people who made the big mainframe computers because their customers wanted massive volume, faster, more bells and whistles. They didn't want some cheap tinny thing that you could carry around that was portable but couldn't do all those bells and whistles. So they looked at their customer base, their market, and they said, there's no future there. That's not what our customers want. That's not what our market is. And so somebody else muscled in at the low end, just the way VW did and their first Toyotas and the way the first transistor radios did. And once they got a foothold with people who hadn't even been able to afford the old products, those products increased over time, and now we use lots of mid-sized offices use only laptops or use only desktops. So that becomes a model for asking what happens to the people who produced it in the old way. And we think it's very helpful. This isn't all coming along here, Rob, but let's try to give it another click. So we think it's very important to look at three aspects of disruptive innovation theory, or the components of the theoretical framework that Christensen's developed. One is the business model that harnesses the technology. Christensen's point is it's not the technology itself will not create those changes out there. It takes a different business model to harness and implement it and have it go to scale. Two, there's something called the value network, which has to do with the network of suppliers and distributors that has to be compatible with that business model. New business models can't be plunked down in the middle. We could give lots of examples from other industries. And finally, there needs to be a conducive standards and policy environment. And that includes when you're talking about education or healthcare, since the government's such a big player as a third-party payer, that includes a lot of government regulation. We'll come back to that. So for business models, we just want to, and this really building on what you've done so well, Stephen, what Stanford did was they took a course they developed internally and distributed it around the world, the artificial intelligence course, those other two courses. We can imagine courses being developed. In a sense, textbook publishers developed courses, and professors adopted them and brought them in. That could be done in virtually as well. So we can talk about inside and outside models. We can talk about facilitated networks of consumers who have help dealing with all these possibilities. We can talk about unbundling product innovation. That's the curriculum development. Western Governors University, it's not the professors of Western Governors University who developed that curriculum, who developed that course. I did when I taught it. Keep out of this, administrators. I will develop my course, thank you. That has been centralized in some places and can be running out of time. So in closing, and I want to turn it over to Bob, there are huge potentials here for capturing the personalization that Candace and Cameron are talking about and getting the economies of scale that Stephen is talking about. But it's going to take different business models, different value networks, and a different regulatory environment to realize that potential. And Bob will talk about those last two parts.
Yeah, just to summarize on Steve's point, is that the argument is that technology alone cannot do it, but when they're harnessed by disruptive business models, technology can lead to the productivity, but they've also got to be associated with changes in the larger value network that universities are sitting inside and the policy environment. The value network, the argument is basically you've got all these different partners and suppliers that surround universities and colleges, that they also are dealing with major changes in an industry like Rob was talking about. So imagine is in the environment of higher education, you've got a game of musical chairs, except the players are moving, but also the chairs are moving. So everybody is playing a different role, struggling in terms of how I make money. Think about what's going on right now in the assessment and credentialing side of the industry. You're having major changes in assessment credentialing bodies now saying, why do I need universities? Why do I need colleges? I can do forward integration and basically partner with test prep organizations and allow certifications to lie outside of universities and colleges. You've got learning content development distribution. Think of what's going on in the publishing industry right now. It is a major changes in fundamental business models of which the content creators are not just the MOOCs, but it's also publishing houses who can say, I can do forward integration, and the big model coming up now is curriculum as a service. Think of software as a service. Think of curriculum as a service. I'm not doing books. I'm doing fully loaded services. Choose one. I'll give you a service. So think of that in the environment. Think about the transformation of academic libraries. I think about public library, but imagine now, how do you think about libraries? Who are they competing with for information services? Everybody in the world now. You've got for-profit venture capital coming in, trying to do massive big data projects, right? You have people doing metadata services, not cataloging, metadata services that transform this function. Think about learning infrastructure services, and don't just think about learning management systems. Think about Amazon. Amazon's a publisher now. Who knows what business they're going to be in to forward their capability in cloud services. Institutional and program assurance, not just in the business of traditional accreditation bodies anymore. We now have other players playing that role. If you just switch it to the next. Then I want to go to the last one, which is the standards and regulatory environment. It is something that also has to be thought of when you think about policy implications. We have the American National Standards and Conformity Assessment System, which has played a major role in other industries in enabling competition through interoperability. We have not seen the same movement in the education industry. I keep saying industry. It's an industry like any other industry. We have not seen the role yet of the standards environment in playing an enabling role. It's now just emerging, but they're some of the areas that are now moving forward in the standards environment, which are enabling future disruption. The last one is just a policy and regulatory environment, and I think people can understand these are major areas that government has a role in either enabling or holding back disruptive business model innovation in higher ed. So if I go to the next one, just for time's sake, in terms of implications, Steve and I, along with Lewis Sorys, there's a forthcoming policy brief on business model innovation and its implications for government policy. And I just want to that'll come out Thursday, I think, will be posted. So I don't want to cover some of the groundwork in that. But let me think in terms of four other areas that are, I'm not saying policy recommendations, but these are areas that we have to think about in terms of public policy implications. If you really want to have technology-enabled business model transformation, like you heard today, what are some of the things that would have to change in the environment, policy environment, to enable that to happen? Number one, think about it in healthcare. In healthcare, HHS and others put out a white paper on how we have to do a public-private standards movement to enable electronic healthcare records. It was a major initiative going on. Think about the last mile problem in personalization is data integration and interoperability of learningware. Who's going to set the game for that? Well, in healthcare, government played a major role in orchestrating standards bodies to move in that direction and fill in the holes. And now it took a long time, but we're not there yet. We haven't even started that in education. Second of all, which I love the quote from Christensen, is like, if you look at the architecture of a product or service, it reflects the organization of the players who made it, right? So they said, basically, I can see the organizational chart of a company inside the architecture of a product. Well, think about this. Accreditation, which is our number one source of quality assurance, really has legacy assumptions on the production of a service. We really assume certain things about how we produce things. What we proposed in this article that's on the table, is we would have to move to open architecture accreditation with the idea that I don't know the business model that will make transformations in services, so I've got to have an open architecture approach to accreditation. Just the last question, I'm out of time, is think about what Cameron mentioned about it was personalization. The last mile problem in personalization is full data integration. I can collect data out of the Carnegie Mellon stuff, right? I can collect data out of Khan, but I need to have total integration for the personalization of learning so different learning content can be brought to bear. We are now spending how many millions of dollars in federal and state data infrastructure? Right now, we have to think in terms of what is the next step in data integration to create a data infrastructure that does the last mile for personalization.
Wonderful. Okay, so we got about maybe 20 minutes for comments and discussion. If folks want to start off, just raise your hand and identify yourself. I will start off then with a, first of all, a comment. Is I really understand how innovation doesn't happen because I used to be an adjunct faculty 20 years ago, and I would type something out and Xerox it and hand it to my students, and I would just be completely lost. At least it would certainly take me a long time to figure all this new stuff out. I feel like an old fogey. Because it really is a different system now than it was in the old days of just kind of craft production of the individual craftsmen and then doing their production to a small group of students. My question to all of you is, if you're a congressional staffer, what do you do in relation to this? What's one idea that they could take away from this to say, or somebody at Department of Ed writing regulations, what's one idea that they can take away to begin to move this ball, Stephen?
Since everything I've said is controversial.
Mike, and closer.
Since everything I've said is sort of controversial
anyway, this one idea would be in that category, but it's been proposed by Arthur Hauptman and a bunch of other people who are interested in this field. And it is the idea that the government has been pouring in these large amounts of money over each year. I mentioned $220 billion. That's federal and state. Hauptman says that the doing that actually results in universities getting more expensive because they're responding to the availability of these funds by doing things that make them cost more. This is Arthur Hauptman I'm speaking about, and many others have written about this. So one possible agenda would be to consider either targeting much more carefully where that that money goes. States are $80 billion and the rest of it is federal government. Targeting exactly where that goes or maybe even limiting it.
So don't you do accreditation on your credit hours?
Okay. Well, Steve, why don't you use that mic down there?
Okay.
We'll leave this.
Yeah.
Well, I hate to be limited to one, but of the several I can think of, one that jumps to mind is the requirements in these 220 billion worth of grant programs, but Pell grants and the loan programs that the government offers are very expensive, and it's true for state loan programs as well. And usually they're contingent on students completing a certain number of credit hours. The whole idea of the unit of credit hours, Candace, this goes to a question that came up at, if you're still there, that came up at the Capitol Hill briefing that Carnegie Mellon did a few weeks ago. You're able to do a statistics course in 8 weeks that used to take 15, and the students learn just as much and retain just as much a year later. But typically, the 7 weeks that are saved are still part of the course and are used for some other purpose. We don't say we can get to that degree in 3 years because we can now teach statistics in other courses in 8 weeks instead of 15 weeks. Part of that is shaped by a policy environment that says you have to fulfill so many credit hours in order, 120, whatever it is, in order to get a degree. One of the great things about Western Governors University is that it's competency-based. And students could advance at their own speed. And the federal government needs to think through more clearly how its policies, including its loan policies, shape that.
Great. Candace, did you want to jump in? If you do, just go ahead and jump in. Otherwise, I'll turn to Cameron.
Okay, I can just say that with respect to the accelerated statistics course, That was a course where students completed the full course that usually takes 15 weeks with four class meetings a week. They completed it in 8 weeks with two class meetings a week. So it was actually an acceleration both in elapsed time and also number of instructor contact hours. And when we did this study at Carnegie Mellon, and done it several times, that we didn't, the students were finished in 8 weeks. They didn't have the extra class. What I was talking about at the event in Washington is that other institutions, as they're using the statistics course and getting that acceleration benefit, because I think of this restriction, are then using the additional 7 weeks to do other additional things in the class, some of which I think is educationally really valuable, like much more application targeted to personalization for the learner. So I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but I would agree that moving more towards looking at what are the competencies that we expect students to achieve, as opposed to how much time are they spending attempting to achieve those competencies, would be a much better measure. And now what the information technology allows us to do, which we weren't able to do before, is measure competency in a much more exacting way, so we can, instead of just high stakes tests. So I agree that that would be a move to make.
Great. Thank you. Cameron?
So I would say the first thing is take the work that Bob and Steve talked about in healthcare and really build a model for portability in education. This current economy that we are recovering from and will be in around the world for quite some time is causing a lot of mobility for individual citizens wherever they are. And they're going to move and go to wherever they can find better economic opportunities for them, which means that their career in college will have fits and starts along the way. They need to be able to have their education record actually follow them, just like their medical records can now follow them. No more this drama that people have to go through of actually having transfer costs from one university to the next, or getting transcripts. All of the additional costs, if you don't finish at the university you started at, you end up graduating with far more credits than you actually needed to attain a degree, which creates additional costs for that consumer in achieving any type of diploma from a higher education institution. If they own their academic record versus some institution owning their academic record, it changes the marketplace dynamically. And today, as long as higher education institutions own the academic record, they get to set the cost level for what that consumer can pay. And I think if from a policy standpoint, we need to be more ardent and supportive of getting the standards bodies that are in place. There's a PES standard here in DC. There's the CIF standard for K-12. Those two need to be highly combined so that we can actually get a lot more innovation in the market. If we don't get those standards in place, a lot of the transferability that we need to have for our citizens, just looking at it from an anthropologist perspective, our citizens are going to be on the move. We need to make their education follow them.
Well, that's a great point, and particularly starting with K-12, putting it all together. I mean, in my view, we should all have our own personalized education record and take that throughout our lives, including post-graduate credentialing, all of it. Elliot, you want to identify yourself first?
Elliot Maxwell. I've done a little writing about openness in higher education. Two questions, if I could. One for Candace, and that is how much of the work on an OLI is getting people to focus on a set of identifiable learning objectives for the competency, which is not necessarily the model that you would have in traditional higher education, and a kind of clarity about what you're trying to do, what you're trying to achieve, how you get there, and the means to test for the accomplishment of those objectives. So that's one question. The second question is, should we be optimistic about changes in, for instance, accreditation, when the last experience with proposals to change the model for accreditation met with a Congress saying the Department of Education can't spend any money whatsoever on changes in accreditation?
So, Candace, why don't you do the first one, and Sue takes the second.
Okay. So, yes, a large amount of time is spent. And I want to say that in our the way we're working now is cross-institutionally, because we believe that defining those outcomes, if we want these learning environments to be used by multiple institutions, because I think there's a cost savings if you have multiple institutions, host one institution or one faculty member attempting to design an environment and then hope that other people will use it, which we know in higher education will not work. But so we spend a lot of time with collections of faculty across institutions articulating what does it mean to say that a student is competent at the introductory level of, say, statistics. So a lot of time is spent talking, defining the student-centered observable outcomes, defining the big picture, how all those outcomes hang together in a coherent whole, and then what kinds of activities do we have the students engage in that both support them to achieve those outcomes, but also authentically assess their progress towards those outcomes as they're learning. That is essentially the design process. And I think that it's critical that faculty be essentially in the lead of that definition and creation.
Great, thank you.
I think accreditation, I agree with you, we had an experience with accreditation. Let me suggest a kind of a fresh start on that. Think about what Cameron talked about, the standards bodies. In standards, we have standards and conformity assessment systems, right? An assessment is a type of conformity assessment. Does a student know that? But also conformity assessment, does a provider of service conform and can they do it? So I guess what I'm suggesting is that we need a kind of a restart. And I would propose what I really enjoyed about the medical example was they, in a sense, moved it out to a public-private standard-setting bodies to come up with standards for everything, like and then you have conformity assessment standards, which are quality assurance, like accreditation, and then regulatory policy refers to those standards. So then you take it outside of the basically government, and we even have policy on that in other agencies where they recognize voluntary consensus standards in industries as the basis for regulatory policy. We see that in medical care, environmental policy. We do not see that in education. And so I guess what I'm saying is that you need to do them both outside.
I just a kind of question. The standards, in essence, right now, are you have to be accredited. I mean, it is a private standard, but it's a private standard that's based on a community of organizations that belong to the accrediting organization. So it's not the government setting the standards. The government does recognize that and says, if you're accredited.
Yeah, I think so, you're right. But I think about the idea of open architecture standards. Right now, that those bodies are not doing open architecture. For example, think about the unbundling of services that we talked about with MOOCs. I could accredit or I could certify a provider of instructional services. So open architecture basically, in my opinion, is I don't know how you're going to organize services, but I can, in a sense, give confidence to consumers and others that you do what you say you do and get results, and I can accredit any bundle of services, no matter what. And what we now have, we have a closed architecture accreditation system based upon a dominant business model, and we've not been able to break through that dominant business model.
Isn't the problem, though, that the fundamental problem to me is you've got the provision of the service or the sale of the product, if you will, tied to the issuance of the certificate. And if you could separate those out, we're basically, to go to Cameron's model, it's consumerization. The student, the learner, goes and says, I think this class here at Stanford's fantastic. I'm going to do that, but I want to go to GMU and listen to Stephen in person. And I'm going to mix and match a little bit, and then I'm going to get it accredited all as a package by somebody else. I mean, isn't that ultimately what we have to get to?
If I could mention about the business models, the professional certifications, right now we've historically linked the two. You have to, in some cases, go to an accredited program to stand for a test, a certification test, but in many now we're seeing the unbundling of that, where certification bodies are separating themselves from the delivery of service and saying, I don't care where you got it. Just if you basically have some evidence, so I think that's the beginning of the unbundling of certification and assessment services from the delivery of instructional services. And then think about what kind of competition that creates in some sort of spark for innovation.
It's a separation.
One of my concerns about those kinds of models is the we should be careful about unbundling things that maybe should be bundled more tightly. And I would say that two things that maybe should be bundled more tightly that are too unbundled now is assessment and instruction. The whole idea that we give someone, a learner, some big high-stakes summative assessment to assess really complex knowledge that we want them to have and then use that to decide what they get and don't get, I think that's a problem, especially now that we can use the technology to get a much more robust idea of that learner's knowledge state by looking at their performance across tasks over a long period of time. So, and my concern is if we unbundle too much assessment and instruction, we are going to be sort of exacerbating that problem of having high-stakes summative assessments being what is the gatekeeper for all people.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I don't think that's in conflict at all with what we're saying, because I think it's almost like you tightly bundle assessment and learning, and then you unbundle overall, adding it all up into a certain number of units or whatever you want to call it to say, I have a degree. I think that's what everybody's saying here.
So one issue that raises is, could you have accreditation for courses? A Straighter Line is out there offering courses for a song, and they're quality courses, but they have a huge accreditation challenge. And they're trying to work through the system and find clever ways around it. But Elliot, you had some thoughts on this.
I actually would like to open it up to everybody. We'll come back, Elliot, if we need to.
It's one possibility. One possibility is seems to me to help square the circle in this discussion is this question of competence, right? Because what do consumers and employers really, really want at the end of the day, right? They want the competences that they will help them lead a rich life, but get a job, right, and lead a paid life. So to what extent is accredited, is certification certifying competence, right, rather than just you took these classes, right, or you took these classes from this accredited institution,
right,
and so on. So to the degree to which, you know, a tightly bundled class like the Carnegie Mellon class assures competence at the end of it, right? And at the end of taking, picking and choosing all of those different classes, you have a bundle of competences that you want someone somehow to certify so that you can go to the marketplace. So how does accreditation in the future or certification deal with that?
I was thinking about it in terms of if you look at the standards and processes that certification bodies use for professional certifications or industry standards of certification, they adhere to a much higher standard of what the quality of assessment is and all the processes versus grades and whatever we get in our higher education. They're almost like non-comparable. And so I think if we use the same litmus test on what's good enough for assessment, in higher education credentialing, that would be a big step up for sure. So I guess what I'm saying is they're kind of different. That stuff of individual competency testing and professional licensing certification are kind of on a different track than what we see in assessment and credentialing in traditional higher education. So I'd love to see it tightened up, and maybe by this tension that emerges, maybe it's going to tighten that up. But right now, I don't see the similarities between the two. I think assessment is really still in the hands of faculty members, in a large sense, in higher education. It really hasn't, like in other models where you see in for-profit institutions, and I think Western governors, they've separated the testing and certification from the actual instruction. And they're not unbundled it like Candace talked about, but they have different people responsible for, so one is a third-party person doing a quality assurance check, which to me is an interesting model.
I would add to that one of the things that makes Western Governors such an interesting phenomenon, one that's grown hugely, it's 25,000, could be 250,000 eventually, is what you're describing, because it more conveniently fits into a competency-based where somebody is looking at that as part of the actual curriculum and within the university structure. And it seems to me that they may be a little bit closer to what you're describing, even though a lot of people aren't too sure exactly in the United States what Western Governors is. I think pretty soon more and more people will know it.
Let me add a comment to that. If you look at how so many for-profit institutions have come about, they were able to acquire failing private institutions or already accredited institutions and take their accreditations and take them to scale. There's nothing that would prevent someone from saying, here's a degree plan, but I'm not going to teach a single course. I'm going to give you all of the course offerings that are available free across the United States or around the world, but I'm going to use my accreditation to validate those courses for you and present you with a degree. In the real world, for the rest of us, as long as you have an accredited degree from an institution, at the end of the day, the brand names behind those degrees don't matter as long as it's a valid degree. And if we don't start thinking about these marketplaces in academic sense, then the IT costs will never come into play. In the model I just described, there's virtually no cost because there's no people. You're leveraging the work, the curriculum development, and the people of institutions around the world and really community sourcing knowledge so that you can actually have a degree program. And innovation and technology allows people to do that. We have to start thinking about getting the learner in the center of this versus the institution in the center of it so that they have those type of choices. Because even in a state system, a public state system, it would be smarter for that state to allow a student to be able to take courses from any college and university in the state system and have a high degree of portability between all of them than forcing them to have to make those type of choices. Because for the state, it keeps that citizen in the state and allows them to keep paying taxes in the state. And we have to start thinking about that marketplace versus saying, I only had to go to this one university because they were the only ones that could grant me a degree. And that limits their options. Consumers are not going to tolerate that.
But Cameron, the fundamental problem with that is who would you root for in the NCAA?
Wouldn't that be the rough? You can still choose a team.
One of the things that comes immediately to mind is fraud and abuse, of which the for-profits are being accused virtually every day. And there's more and more data that says that some institutions who've gone a route of offering things very quickly to everybody don't assess their student competence very well. And in many cases seem to be using this sort of, hey, you can get it fast and quick here, to get people engaged in rather serious loans. So I just bring this up because how do you test competency and make it meaningful? And I think that is a very big problem.
Yeah, if I can, how do we assess, I guess what I don't disagree with the thing you're saying, but also we have to look in terms of comparing that to not what we think good higher education traditional is, but the reality of it. So the question is, what's assessment practice we have in the traditional higher education system? Do we really have good quality control on assessment in the higher education system we have now? Do we really do it well? And I guess I project that we, that's a big unknown, very different quality standards for that all over the place. We also don't have the greatest completion rates, right? We need to look at the hard look at our traditional system in light of what's going on in the for-profit world. But I think the most important thing going in the for-profit world is not tax status, but it's the centralization of a certain function called product development, which is the import-export model, and the separation of third-party assessment and certification going on. I think that's the new business model, and we tend to wash over that based upon issues of tax status. That's, to me, the revolution going on in higher education. It's at Western Governors. It's also in the for-profit sector. The new entrants coming in are going to be coming from outside the traditional higher education sector, regardless of tax status. I think that's the revolution, which we'll get to, I think, the productivity issues.
I think tax status.
We're
going to
stop, and I want to let one more person go before we end. So if you have a question, maybe afterwards. So, yes, sir.
One quick point. I noticed Cameron's bio said that he had participated in SIPA.
Yes, sir.
And that was an investment that Microsoft, I can say this, Microsoft put in 1995 or 1996, something like that. That has significantly lowered the costs of K-12 administration through interoperability. Second was the University of Freiburg. Remember that in Europe,
the faculty member is the one who makes the choice of whether a course is qualified or not for transfer, not the registrar. And so in the case of the University of Freiburg, they're under the Bologna process, so the faculty member can make that choice, which then comes up that Europe has all of these standards you're talking about in place, and have had it for several years. It's taken a long time to get there, but they do an incredibly good job, and of course, we in the United States refuse to consider anything that's outside the U.S.
Well, especially if it's from Europe.
I'm not.
Even the Canadians are suspect.
So, Europe.
So I would love to continue this because it's been fascinating, and I think one of the things that makes it so fascinating is it's a little bit sort of like how a lot of industries were 10 years ago. They were really ready to churn over and to be transformed by these technologies and these business models and these entrepreneurs, and you kind of get the sense that we're potentially at that point now where my son, who's 20, his college experience is going to be pretty much fixed, but my daughter, who's much, much younger, I think she's going to be in a much different environment than my son is in, and we can all hope that we get there faster rather than later. So I particularly want to thank Candace for joining us, and also four great speakers here, and please join me in thanking them and thank you all.